Ars Electronica, 2006. Simplicity, the art of complexity.
Eddie ist ein Kunstwissenschaftler, aber auch mit medientheoretischen Sidekicks. He has been working for a long time at Duke University in North Carolina, and since 2004 he is professor of art history at Savannah College. I just asked him where that is. It is in Georgia, 20 minutes from the coast. And sorry for asking such silly questions, but he has been publishing a couple of books on the topics. Maybe the most prominent one is The Telematic Embrace, which is more or less an anthology of the writings of Roy Ascott, but with a long and very detailed analysis introduction by Eddie. And I think that Roy Ascott will play again a role today in his talk, but this will be enriched by various other artists who make up a scenario a little bit, tell me if I'm right, of pros and cons to the relation of cybernetics and arts. So we will see that this is not like introducing itself without some resistance on the part of the art world. And the title of his talk is Cybernetics and Art, Convergences and Divergences in the 1960s. And Eddie will be with us again on Monday on a panel that Andreas Bruckmann and I am hosting. You're welcome to come back again. It's the second manifestation during Ars Electronica of the Boltzmann Institute, which talks about placing and replacing media art in a more contemporary discourse. It's Monday afternoon. You'll find it in the program.
Thank you for that introduction, Dieter, and for the invitation to participate in this conference, which I'm finding very interesting. If you just bear with me for a minute, I have an image of a work by Roy Ascott from about 1962-63, which was influenced by cybernetics but takes as its model Marcel Duchamp's Large Glass. So I thought that might be a topical thing just to show. There it is. So you can see the seed cloud and the division of the screen, albeit on the horizontal, into two fields. Instead of having the chocolate grinders, you have a sort of a circuit diagram on the left generating the current that then would impregnate the bride on the right side of the screen there. Okay. So my talk today is Cybernetics and Art, Convergences and Divergences in the 1960s. Hungarian-born artist Niklas Schoeffer created his first cybernetic sculptures, CISP-0 and CISP-1, in 1956. And as I noted, the title is an acronym for Cybernetic plus Spatiodynamic. He'd been creating these spatiodynamic sculptures for several years, coming out of a constructivist model. And this work interacted with dancers of the Maurice Béjart troupe in 1956 at the Sarah Bernhardt Theater. So there's another instance of dance and technology very on. It was with a concrete music work by Pierre Henry. Curator Yasha Reichardt's exhibition, Cybernetic Serendipity, popularized the idea of joining cybernetics and art, opening at the ICA in London in 1968, and subsequently traveling to Washington, D.C. and San Francisco between 69 and 70. Much artistic research on cybernetics transpired between Schoeffer's initial experiments in the mid-50s and Reichardt's landmark exhibition some decade later. Art historian Jack Burnham, whose name has also come up today, noted that these inquiries into the aesthetic implications of cybernetics took place primarily in Europe, whereas the United States lagged behind by five or ten years. Although there was much fanfare in support of art and technology in the 1960s, the cultural attitudes and ideals that cybernetics embodied at that time were not univocal. On the one hand, art historian David Meller observed that A dream of technical control, of instant information conveyed at unthought of velocities, haunted 60s culture. The wired electronic outlines of a cybernetic society had become apparent to the visual imagination, an immediate future drastically modernized by the impact of computer science. It was a technologically utopian structure of feeling, positivistic and scientistic. And this word scientistic is a curious word. I don't know how I'd translate it into German, even if I could. But in English, it's a curious word, too. It's as opposed to scientific, which is rigorous and actual science. Scientistic is maybe superficial science. It looks like science, but it's not really science. It's pseudoscience. Evidence of these sentiments could be observed in British painting, especially by a group of artists associated with Roy Ascott and the new cybernetic art curriculum he instituted at the Ealing College of Art in the early 60s. These artists included R.B. Kitaj, Bernard Cohen, and Steve Willits. Cybernetics offered these and other European artists a scientific model for constructing a system of visual signs and relationships. Such work often utilized diagrammatic and interactive elements to create works that functioned as information systems or emulated feedback loops and electrical circuits. At the same time, artist Gustav Metzger, who theorized auto-destructive art in 1959 and organized the Destruction in Art Symposium in 1966, had a less sanguine outlook on the technological future. And here's Metzger on the left doing a demonstration of auto-destructive art in front of the Hayward Gallery in 65. He would spray hydrochloric acid on nylon sheeting and it would destruct in real time. But he also had theorized the use of computers as early as 1959 as an element in auto-destructive art. In another vein, artists associated with Art and Language, the British collective, made work that mocked cybernetic art, such as Harold Harrell's cybernetic artwork That Nobody Broke on the right, and I'll discuss this at greater length later. The following discussion addresses some of the broad aesthetic underpinnings that enabled cybernetics to be applied to art in the 1960s, and considers both sincere and ironic treatments of cybernetics in aesthetic context of the period. Okay. While cybernetics offered a flexible theory that was adaptable to a wide range of applications in the sciences, social sciences, and humanities, it might be argued that in the absence of a complementary aesthetic context, there would have been no common ground, no common language for the accommodation of cybernetics to artistic concerns. It is safe to say that the particular ways in which that scientific theory was utilized by artists depended in part on existing correspondences between aesthetics and cybernetics. Roy Ascott's change painting, seen here from 1960, predated the artist's awareness of cybernetics. Yet this reconfigurable painting demanded an exchange of information between the artist, viewer, and object as part of a contingent system of interconnected feedback loops, anticipating Ascott's subsequent elaboration of cybernetic art and theory. And he wrote in 1960 of this work, "Interchangeable elements, each with an individual identity, may, by the physical participation of the spectator, be brought into a series of relationships, each one adding up to a whole which is more directly related to the manipulator of the parts than if it were static and at a distance. The act of changing becomes a vital part of the total aesthetic experience of the participant." Thus, while the artist was not familiar with the concepts of contingency, feedback, and systems within the framework of cybernetics as theorized by Norbert Wiener and others, his artistic concerns resulted in the expression of related ideas in visual form, indicating how scientific ideas and artistic ideas are complementary and can arise independently from many common sources of human knowledge and social exigency. Some of the aesthetic foundations that enabled the convergence of art and cybernetics in the 60s will be outlined below. Now, this is a very problematic slide, and I don't intend to create a narrative history here. I just want to put up some touching points of ideas that emerged in science, technology, engineering, and art that could be seen as important monuments in an evolving set of ideas about motion, subjectivity, interactivity, perception, and so forth. Building on research on perception carried out by prior generations of artists, inventors, and scientists, early 20th century artists challenged representational conventions by depicting sensations, multiple perspectives, and wrinkles in space and time. Early experiments with putting visual form into actual motion included Duchamp's rotary glass plates, Thomas Wilfrid's clavilux, and Nam Gabo's kinetic construction, standing wave. Gabo's work, for example, produced a virtual volume only when activated, making motion, therefore, an intrinsic quality of the art object, further emphasizing the aspect of time. You know it makes noise, okay? By the 1950s, experimentation with duration and motion by artists, including Schoeffer, Jean Tanguy, and Takis, gave rise to the broad international movement known as kinetic art. And I should mention, I made my own video of this work, Chronos 5, by Nicolas Schoeffer, that I had the great opportunity to see at the Lichtkunst aus Kunstlicht exhibition at the ZKM that Margit had a role in helping to create. And it was really an extraordinary, ambitious, comprehensive exhibition. And I'll show some more work from that as well. It was really a great opportunity to see. Schoeffer's CISP one on the upper left that we looked at before was programmed to respond electronically to its environment, actively involving the viewer or the dancer in the unpredictable experience of the work as it interacted with the environment, including the people in it. CISP one drew on ideas that had been percolating for three quarters of a century at least and intentionally merged them with a relatively new field of cybernetics. The interactive spirit of kinetic art was shared by Nouvelle Tendance collectives working with diverse media to explore various aspects of motion, perception, and audience participation. These groups included the group Recherche d'Art Visuel, or GRAV, in Paris and Zero in Germany, represented here by François Morellet and Otto Pina, whose works were also in the ZKM exhibition. Also that year, 1962, in Paris, French artist Jacques Gabriel exhibited paintings Cybernétique 1 and Cybernétique 2 in an exhibition called Catastrophe, a group show and happening organized by artist Jean-Jacques Lebel and gallerist Raymond Cordier. The poster publicizing the event stated, "L'art et le cybernétique, c'est la même chose. Art and cybernetics, they're the same thing." Taking audience participation in the direction of political action, after 1957, the Situationist International Theory of Détournement offered a strategy for how artists might alter pre-existing aesthetic and social circumstances in order to reconstruct the conditions of everyday life. And this might be also placed sort of in the context of that discussion between Boys and Benza about sort of expanding consciousness by jarring people out of preconceived notions. Included in the Cybernetic Serendipity exhibition were several cybernetic works that interacted with their environments. Margit very eloquently talked about Colloquy of Mobiles, so I won't discuss that, but on the left is a piece by Wenying Tsai, Cybernetic Sculpture. This is a later version than the one exhibited at Cybernetic Serendipity. It interacted to light and sound in its environment, and those little rods with reflective discs vibrated. Edward Inatowicz's sound-activated mobile reacted to sound in this very biomorphic manner on this sort of skeletal form. Okay. The aesthetic strategy of engaging the audience more directly in a work became an important compositional strategy in Western concert music, as we heard just a few minutes ago, which through cross-fertilization played a major role in the development of participatory art in the U.S. and internationally. Although not directly related to cybernetics, these artistic pursuits, like Ascot's change painting, can be interpreted loosely as an independent manifestation of the aesthetic concern with the regulation of a system through the flow of information between its elements. The most prominent example of this tendency in Western concert music is American composer John Cage's 433, which premiered in 1952. Originally performed on piano, but having no notes, this piece invoked the chance, ambient sounds of the environment, such as the listener's own breathing, a neighbor's cough, the crumpling of a candy wrapper, as integral to its content and form. Cage's lectures at the New School influenced numerous visual artists, notably Alan Kaprow, the founder of Happenings, and George Brecht and Yoko Ono, whose event scores from the late 1950s anticipated Flux's performance. It must be noted, as Kaprow claimed, that the emergence of various performative strategies in visual art were equally influenced by the gestural corporeal processes involved in Jackson Pollock's so-called drip paintings, as revealed in Hans Nemeth's famous series of photographs, Pollock Painting. So it wasn't just the paintings themselves, but the paintings in combination with the photographs demonstrating the process that really sort of struck a chord with many artists involved in the development of Happenings and performance. Also related to developments in experimental music, the visual effects of electronic feedback became a focus of artistic research in the late 60s when video equipment first reached the consumer market. By the mid-60s, audio feedback and the use of tape loops, sound synthesis, and computer-generated composition had become widespread in experimental music following the pioneering work of composers like Schaeffer, Cage, Stockhausen, and Xenakis beginning in the 50s, and maybe even the late 40s in the case of Schaeffer and concrete music. Perhaps most emblematically, the feedback of Jimi Hendrix's screaming electric guitar at Woodstock appropriated the American national anthem as a countercultural battle cry. Of course, with guitar feedback, you have sound coming out of the speaker, going into the pickups on the guitar, creating this system, a positive feedback loop. And a positive feedback loop goes out of control, and the whole system either explodes or it goes to a null state. In this case, it sort of overloads in an overwhelming way. The use of closed-loop video for visual art enabled the creation of cybernetic systems in which the viewer and the work were inextricably bound. Such work includes Les Levine's interactive installations, Iris and Contact, in which video cameras captured various images of viewers which were displayed, often with time delays or other distortions, onto a bank of monitors. As Levine noted, Iris, quote, turns the viewer into information. Contact is a system that synthesizes man with his technology. The people are the software, end quote. A similar approach was taken in Wipe Cycle, 1969, by Frank Gillette and Iris Schneider, who amplified Levine's view of interactive video installation, stating that, quote, the most important function was to integrate the audience into the information. Gillette added that it, quote, rearranged one's experience of information reception. Namjoon Paik's TV Buddha from 1974, in this work, a bronze statue of Buddha meditates on its own video image on a TV monitor, which is very fashionably styled in the shape of a space helmet. And this offered an ironic twist on these sorts of experiments. And Paik also drew an interesting parallel between cybernetics and Buddhism. He wrote in 1966, "Cybernated art is very important, but art for cybernated life is more important, and the latter need not be cybernated." And he goes on this comparison. The Buddhists also say karma samsara, relationship is metempsychosis. And I could show many other examples, including Dan Graham as Cornelius Bonk did, Bruce Nauman's live tape video corridor, many examples of closed-loop video feedback systems in art in the 60s and early 70s. I'm not sure if there's a real contrast here, but perhaps in contrast to the closed-loop video works, video feedback can also involve a dynamic recursive flow of visual information produced when the camera records the imagery displayed on its own monitor. If the system offers no negative feedback, it becomes overloaded and unstable, producing unpredictable effects, as in the guitar feedback. To artists like Woody and Stein of Asulka, this video analog to electric guitar feedback was, quote, "an uncontrollable, roiling, effluent byproduct of technology, one of those natural mysteries, appreciated but untamable." They experimented with a wide variety of feedback techniques using all manner of and combination of audio and video signals to generate electronic feedback in their respective or corresponding media. As Woody wrote, quote here, "We look at video feedback as electronic art material. It's the clay, it's the air, it's the energy, it's the stone. It's the raw material that you build an image with." For American video artist Skip Sweeney, it was, quote, "a religion, a wave to ride." So those parallels between religion and technology that came up earlier are exemplified here as well. In these ways, just to sum up some of these tendencies, 20th century experimental art tended to focus on temporality, to put art into motion, to invoke interaction with the viewer, and to conceive of art as a system. In general, it emphasized the artistic process as opposed to the product, and accentuated the environment or context, often the social context, as opposed to conventional content. These tendencies helped to form the aesthetic context in which cybernetics and its emphasis on systems and feedback loops converged with art. They also provide strong theoretical and aesthetic foundation for the elaboration of more contemporary media art. Before I go here, I should mention that Roy Ascott was also one of the collaborators on the Fun Palace project with Joan Littlewood and Cedric Price. And some of the same ideas involved in that project of creative behavior, education, are present in some of his theories, as I'll mention in a minute. Video Roger Thesaurus, illustrated here, is a diagram overlay in the catalog from Ascott's 1963 solo exhibition in London at the Moulton Gallery. The exhibition was entitled Diagram Boxes and Analog Structures. Here, Ascott equated visual forms, and at this point, he was already fully familiar with cybernetics theory. He'd been reading Wiener, Ashby, Pask, F.H. George, and so on. Okay, so here, Ascott equated visual forms, by which meaning is formally derived, those visual forms on the left, with semantic systems by which meaning is derived by taxonomic relationships, the thesaurus, the textual and diagrammatic elements introducing and suggesting semantic relationships between those forms and fields of meaning. Moreover, in a two-page diagram drawn like an electrical circuit, also in the catalog, Ascott wrote, quote, "This thesaurus is a statement of my intention to use any assembly of diagrammatic and iconographic forms within a given construct as seems necessary." Thus, by explicitly stating his intention to use text in and as art, Ascott strategically expanded the range of what counted as art to include diagrammatic, iconographic, and textual forms as interrelated parts of a cybernetic art system. The universe of potential meanings of such works was to be derived taxonomically and discursively through multi-layered processes in which the flow of information between artists and the objects they make, the semantic systems which govern the reception of the works of art, and the actual responses of viewers were all mutually contingent and related through feedback loops. Ascott's concern with the semantic complexities of visual representation and the relationship between art and text in the 60s presaged the conceptual art practice of American Joseph Kossuth and the British collective Art and Language. Indeed, their work shared Ascott's interest in the taxonomic relations through which semantic meaning is, or fails to be, generated. According to British art historian Charles Harrison, who became a member of Art and Language, but also writes about Art and Language attempted to subvert the logic of art objects through the use of textual interventions in order to interrogate the modernist beholder discourse, using Duchamp's term as he did. To that end, Mel Ramsden's Elements of a Complete Map incorporated four annotated volumes of Roget's thesaurus. Like Ascott's Video Roget from 1963, 5 years earlier, Ramsden's work suggested equivalences between the way in which language signifies meaning in an interconnected rhetorical system like a thesaurus, and the way in which form signifies meaning in an interconnected visual system, such as art. Ascott's cybernetic art employed the further strategy of creating an interactive system or situation that undermined the conventional subject-object relationship between art and audience, thereby raising similar questions about spectatorship. So in this piece, for example, on the left, and this is just a catalog diagram, but perhaps might rightly be considered a work of art in its own right, one participates in this work by flipping the sheet over on top and creating that set of relationships. In the change painting that I showed earlier, and I don't think I have another image of it, but we saw it in two different states. And the way the work was intended to be received by the audience was there were sliding plexiglass sheets, each one of which had a little gestural configuration on it, and the viewer audience became a participator in the work by shifting the orientation of those panes in relation to each other, exploring a multitude, an infinite multitude of compositional possibilities. But whereas Ascott genuinely believed in cybernetics as a practical and intellectual tool for the creation of art, the members of Art and Language were much more skeptical and applied scientific principles to art in a tongue-in-cheek manner, suggesting a parallel between the dogma of cybernetics and the dogma of modernist aesthetics. For example, in Key to 22 Predicates, The French Army, 1967, Terry Atkinson and Michael Baldwin offered a key two abbreviations, all these military acronyms. The French Army, FAA, the Collection of Men and Machines, CMM, and the Group of Regiments, GR. Using logic reminiscent of Lewis Carroll, perhaps another great madman in the history of English culture, the artist then described a variety of relationships amongst these elements as part of a system, and really a system of gibberish. So they write, "The FAA is regarded as the same CMM as the GR, and the GR is the same CMM as, e.g., quote, a new order, FA, paren, e.g., morphologically a member of another class of objects, end paren, colon, by transitivity, the FA is the same CMM as the, quote, new shape slash order one." Okay? This purposely overcomplicated, incomprehensible description through a looking glass, to go back to the Lewis Carroll metaphor, mocks the manner of cybernetic explanations. It reduces to absurdity the systematization of relationships between individuals, groups, and institutions, and in this example in particular, with respect to the military and technology. By contrast, Ascot employed such jargon earnestly, sincerely, when defining his cybernetic art matrix, or CAM, another acronym, a systematic outline for promoting creativity in society. And it's this aspect of Ascot's work that is part of that fun palace ethos of creating a context for the expansion of human creativity and so forth. Okay. In his essay, Behaviorist Art and Cybernetic Vision, 1966 to 67, he established a key to the cybernetic art matrix that included inputs, T1 through T3, procedures, H sub O, L sub O, coordinates, C1 through C3, and context, little ic, little ip, and little io, resulting in codified instructions. And the parallel between art and language mockery should become apparent. For example, quote, T1 slash C23 slash H sub O little IC little IO colon, the highly committed professional artist designer who, while he may have a social L sub O interest in CAM generally, his use of CAM slash L will be of a high order intensity. In terms of C2 slash H sub O little IO, this means, and it goes on and on. Okay, so you see the parallel between the ironic use of these systems, the cybernetic sorts of explanation, and the sincere ones, the ironic and sincere. Okay. A final example. Irony prevails in Harold Harrell's artwork, the cybernetic artwork that nobody broke. This spurious computer program for interactively generating color refuses to allow the user to interact beyond the rigid banality of binary input. If the user inputs a number other than 0 or 1, the program offers the message, quote, you have nothing, obey instructions. If the user inputs a non-number, the cybernetic artwork that nobody broke tells him or her that there is, quote, error at step 3.2. So you're stuck in this system that you can't get out of unless you're engaged in a very limited 0 or 1 mechanism of input and interaction. Harrison has interpreted these experiments as, quote, flailing about, products of the search for practical and intellectual tools that had not already been compromised and rendered euphemistic in modernist use. But they may equally be interpreted as satirical reflections on artists' failure to address the incommensurability of science and art. And I think that incommensurability of science and art is demonstrated very poignantly in the dialogue that we saw earlier between Boyes and Benza. They can be seen also as parodies of the rigid confines within which claims for interactive participation might transpire. Such insights offered a valuable critical perspective on the utopian and scientistic attitudes toward cybernetic art in the 1960s. These various approaches to art and technology, ranging from sincere and skeptical to enthusiastic and ironic, offer useful models for contemporary artistic research incorporating emerging media as well, I believe. Thank you very much.
Yes, Eddie, thanks a lot. I would like to come back to one point that you have been discussing in, I think, your introduction to the Telematic Embrace, and which is very close to also what you have been presenting today. But there you even maybe made it a little bit more sharper in your argument, that you said many of the things that were called cybernetic art might have happened without any reference to cybernetics anyway, because they come from the logic of a certain artistic development that you have been sketching in what you call the problematics collide, going from the end of the representational image up to the introduction of movement into art that continued by integrating the spectator and all the things you have been talking about. So that cybernetic at a certain point in the 1960s development maybe was an interesting theoretical addition, but not necessary for producing the artworks we have seen. So how would you stick to that argument?
Yeah, no, I think that that's right, largely. I think that artists were making work, for example, Ascot's change paintings, that lend themselves to a cybernetic interpretation in terms of feedback loops, generation of information between artist, artwork, and viewer. But they were created before artists were familiar with the idea of cybernetics, or before the artists making those works were familiar with that terminology. At the same time, once cybernetics enters into the discourses of art, I think it takes on a life of its own. So it not just confirms or lends a scientific credibility to the work that artists had been doing prior to an awareness of the science of cybernetics, but it takes on a sort of a cultural imaginary. It becomes part of the lexicon, of the vocabulary, and it gives a language for speaking about what artists had been doing in some ways before. And through that, giving that of that language and providing extra aesthetic models for it, it adds to that discussion. And I think that it grows as a result of that. So I see the two really interacting as part of a larger systemic cultural formation.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for clarifying. Uh-huh. There was a question over there.
Thank you. I'm very glad to hear mentioned the name of Jimi Hendrix at a festival called Ars Electronica. Now, I have to make only a little addition to the feedback loops of Hendrix. Woody Wasulka may have been influenced by Hendrix in this regard, because he was one of the cameramen of the Fillmore East concerts, December 31st, 68, and January 1, 69. And I only wanted to say that. Now, coming to Roy Ascot, he lived in London, Jimi Hendrix lived in London, so the question popping up is, have there been any relationships between Ascot and the rock music scene at that time?
Only indirectly, but that's a really interesting question because the indirect answer is there are a couple notable connections between Roy Ascott and rock music. I know of none between Ascott and Jimi Hendrix, but one of Ascott's students was Peter Townsend, and Ascott invited Gustav Metzger to come give a talk at the school, and he gave a lecture on auto-destructive art. And Peter Townsend later credited Metzger's theory of autodestructive art with giving him the idea for destroying guitars on stage. Metzger also went on to do light shows for The Who and for some other groups. So there's one Ascott connection with rock music. The other connection is with Brian Eno, who is also a student of Ascott's, and who was fooling around with tape loops and things like that, and these cybernetic ideas that he was introduced to at Ipswich, he credited in the book More Dark Than Shark, as really influencing his thinking about music and systems and things like that. Yeah.
The Woody Wasilka quotation that you had there on video feedback was quite amazing, really. It's almost like he was talking about it as if it was God, you know, that you're actually looking at God. I just think that's very interesting because, you know, we're throwing around this concept, cybernetics. And, I mean, if you look at the dictionary definition of that, I've got an English dictionary definition here, Oxford English Dictionary, science of systems of control and communications and living organisms and machines. I mean, what we're doing here is really completely expanding that, you know, way beyond that definition. So I was just kind of interested in Wasilka's, perception. Was cybernetics becomes God, if you like. But it's really something that is beyond our control. You know, that it is out of our control. And, you know, what he is looking at in video feedback is something that we're very familiar with today, you know, in terms of chaos theory and in terms of nonlinear studies and in terms of evolutionary computing and the rest of it. That perhaps that needs to be factored in, you know, to this equation of cybernetics. Mm-hmm. You know, this difference between, you know, that which we, you know, have no control over.
Yeah, to make a point of clarification, it's Skip Sweeney who stated that it was a religion, a wave to ride. Mm-hmm. I think that the Wasilkas were much more interested in it as like clay and charcoal and, you know, the same sort of stuff that artists had always traditionally made art with. Mm. And I think that there is something about working with feedback where, you know, part of cybernetics, I mean, involved in control and communication and the animal and the machine, the tagline to Wiener's famous book. There are aspects of it, including feedback loops, homeostasis, keeping things in balance. And that riding that wave, a wave to ride, as Skip Sweeney also said, it's riding that wave between being out of control and being in control. So there is an indeterminacy, an unexpectedness. You put something through the system, and you're not sure what's going to come back. And it might be wildly out of control. Or you might be able to sort of keep it just within certain parameters or play with that out-of-controlness and that controlness. And I think it's that tension that was really exciting for artists to work with and probably has always been interested for artists to work with, pushing materials just to the edge of our ability to control them. Certainly in Western concert music, there are examples of compositions that force the player to play an instrument beyond the physical capability of humans to perform. So that skirting with control and out of controlness, I think, is a part of that.
That's good, because I think really, you know, the question I was trying to ask, the question I was trying to formulate was, you know, can we define what cybernetics is in the context that we're using it here? So I think what you've just done is a pretty good effort.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a little addendum, actually, to just this exchange. You finished with a rather more skeptical note on the possibility of arts and science being rather incommensurable than easily marriageable, than that there is an easy marriage between of them. I guess this is exactly another way of looking at this very problematic relationship. I mean, this sonding of the limits and of surfing the edge between control and uncontrollability, where we have incommensurability between the two fields, and that's exactly the source of the artistic potential.
I think that's a really interesting point, because to my mind, the most interesting artists today are ones who are working collaboratively with scientists who have become disenchanted with the way science has traditionally been practiced and are looking for non-scientific models with which to approach science. So they call on artists to push the limits. So they're sort of working on science on the edge of control. And artists are working with the scientists on the edge of art. So, you know, through that, it's not just the incommensurability of the two disciplines. It's, I think, a recognition of the limits of any single discipline or any single epistemological model for getting more or a different sort of work done than we've been accustomed to getting done. And by pushing things at the limits of those disciplines and pushing each other through different methods applied to disciplines, I think people are doing really exciting work.
Yes, I think we are pushing now to the limit of this wonderful discussion, which could go on for the rest of the day, I'm sure about it. Mm-hmm. And I propose that we make, and I'm serious about it, a 5-minute break. Yes? It's really 5 minutes, count on one cigarette. Then to start with our finale with Yasia. That means in a quarter to five we will start, yeah? So now it's 20 to five, yeah? Okay. And Yasia will give a talk and will present a couple of historic videos which bring you way back into the times of the CyberNexus serendipity. So you must bring another 40 minutes, I think, which is worth to be here. Okay. Thanks a lot, Amy.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.